So it's that time again.
Really? What time is it?
Time to talk about the Private War of Idaho and Tomorrow is Yesterday, Part 2.
It's called A Private Little War. So let's talk about it.
Okay. Well, the war against America happened when Kirk and Spock went in and Spock got shot and he bled green for the first time.
Yes, that is true.
We've been told this entire time he has green blood. It's nice to actually see it.
It's nice that they remembered that.
Yes, they usually don't remember things.
No, they don't. I don't know. What did you think about A Private Little War?
Both of these episodes were great, horrible episodes.
Yeah, I can see that.
Like, all of the Block episodes are just bad. Like, What Girls Are Made Of and Cat's Paw, they are just unenjoyably horrible. These were not good episodes, but there were a lot of really either funny or interesting or just plain weird stuff in them.
Well,
they were
I
bad,
like,
but not boring.
I like A Private Little War more than I like Return to Tomorrow.
Okay. I like Return to Tomorrow a little more than I like The Private Little War.
Well, then this should be an interesting episode, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing about A Private Little War is there's way too much going on.
Yeah.
There's way too much plot. It's all sort of just kind of there. Like, it's there's too much plot, but it doesn't feel overstuffed for some reason because things happen and they never really remark on it again and they never talk about it. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's that whole subplot with Spock getting shot, which doesn't really serve any purpose except to eat up about 5 minutes of the running time. We also get to meet the cool, you know, Black Doctor, which is nice to see in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Keeping its racial, equality. Yeah, which is nice. You know, the implication there, of course, you know, he studied on Vulcan and he knows Vulcan physiology and McCoy doesn't care enough to learn about it. So, they need somebody.
Yeah. McCoy has this line. It's like, you know, well, his heart's where his liver should be. It's like, no, his heart's where his heart should be. Like that's Spock assumedly developed properly for a Vulcan.
Well, like Zach Hanlon said last week, he's a little bit of a xenophobe.
Oh, that's
he's a little bit of a racist. He's a country doctor.
Oh my God, he's a hick.
Yes, and we've seen that.
Yes.
This Side of Paradise.
That's like one of my favorite. I love when he gets all country doctor.
Yeah, it is funny. I really just wish that there was one episode with him wearing overalls and a straw hat, because that would have just made my day, really.
Yeah.
Eating fried chicken, of course.
I wish I had some fried chicken.
So, and the other thing about the episode too, like there's that weird, there's like the episode turns into a stealth game for about 3 minutes where they're skulking around.
Well,
and
you like stealth games.
No, I do, but it's just, it really just comes out of nowhere and it just feels like it's there to pad the running time again. Well, and nothing comes of that whole sequence.
Well, it's like Legend of Zelda game. There's always that one stealth level that like really doesn't matter and it's really hard and stupid. And then once you do it the once, like, you can go through the castle back and forth. So really, this is why we have Legend of Zelda, this episode.
I mean, it seems to really, I don't know, that whole purpose, the whole scene really serves a purpose, I think, where it just reveals that the Klingons are there.
Yeah.
But the Klingon doesn't really do anything in the episode. It doesn't really, I mean, we could have the episode without the Klingons.
Yeah.
It's just another thing in this episode that is too overplotted.
Yeah, you don't necessarily need an outside influence causing these two tribes or whatever to have warfare. They can have a reason themselves. A lot of this episode seems like they had about 25 minutes worth of show and are just, it's filler. That scene when the witch lady is doing the ritual on Kirk takes like 10 hours.
Yeah.
It's like, she does something and she has a little chant. It's like, okay, that's it. And then she has another chant. It's like, all right, okay. And then she changes her dance. It's like, this keeps going, doesn't it? Like, they really just went with that.
Yeah. I mean, and it's interesting too, right? Because her character is like the archetypal femme fatale, which is really tiresome at this point. And, you know, we've seen those kind of characters nowadays, but they're used sort of ironically to comment on the very idea of the femme fatale. This is definitely a straight up, we think that this is a great thing to do. And it's really not. I mean, it's that sort of like women have mystical powers over men and you know, the only way that they can really get power in a society is to be sort of in the shadows of powerful men and use their feminine wiles on the men and all that kind of stuff. And it just comes across as really creepy.
Well, compare this to the one where they were in the tribe and there was this stuff and there was that really cool lady who was having the baby, but like mountain climbing, and like she and McCoy had that. Like, remember that one?
Yeah, well, no, of course.
Like, that was a
similar. Do I remember it?
I don't even know what that, what was that called?
I don't remember.
Anyway, the weird tribey one.
Yeah.
So, but that character I loved, and she has a very similar role in this, in that she is the chief's wife and that she is, you know, a woman in a society that may, you know, that has some restrictions on women, but that takes her and says, okay, well, but this is still a very strong, intelligent, complex person.
Okay, but
and she's going to have a she's going to be able to get as much done as she can within these strictures.
Okay, but let's okay, I think that's a good comparison. Let's contrast these two characters, right? And I think in that episode, it's a much more interesting take on it, because they state that women are not really powerful in that society, but she has no mystical power. She's not using her feminine wiles.
Yeah.
You know, it's not this really lazy caricature of female sexuality and the power that women can have. I'm reminded of the fact that you know, the United States government is now talking about letting women serve in all combat roles, opening up the military to them entirely. And you know, obviously we're being colored by, you know, being away from this for 50 years. But to me, it just seems like, you know, that episode with the giant people and the baby and all that stuff, you know, she's shown as a smart and capable woman who gets power and gets control through the fact that she is intelligent, not the fact that she's a woman. Whereas
she also has certain, there are restrictions, but she also knows her rights very well. She knows who she is. And while she uses the limited power she has past its general extent and is able to get more than she would have just out of sheer capability.
Yeah, and I also think that we get a much more clear picture of that society in that episode than we do in this one. Because really all we know about the Hill People, as they're called, is that they're peaceful and they're sort of pacifists and they live in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
We don't know anything else about that. I am done with
the Garden of Eden in Star Trek.
No, you're not.
I'm done with it. Star Trek, I know, is not done with it. I know in Wrath of Khan it's a kind of a motif in that as well. But come on.
Well, it goes with the whole Federation as paradise thing, and they're looking for paradise. But I find the character of the wife to be very problematic in this episode.
Well, I can't tell what her goals are. And
her goals seem to be, and this is the thing, right, is that she is the archetypal, like, Black Widow. She's just around to foment chaos and dissent for no reason whatsoever. She's an agent of chaos in this episode.
A bitch goddess.
Exactly. she's a witch, basically.
Well, they literally call her, well, they say her people are a witch, you know.
Yeah.
Tribe or whatever.
I mean, even going to the very end of the episode where she steals Kirk's phaser after she hypnotizes him or whatever she does. And she goes to the foes in the episode, the villagers who have we haven't even gotten into the weapon thing yet, but we'll get there. And she runs to the other side, apparently just because she wants people to kill each other for no particular reason. So she has no logic. She has no goals. She has no loyalty to any one side. She apparently just wants war. And I actually thought that, you know, she was going to be revealed as a Klingon, which I thought would have been very interesting. But they don't go there.
See where I thought this was going, because at the beginning she's saying, you know, we need weapons for our people, and I figured, okay, well then her role in this episode, she believes that, you know, this conflict between her hill people and the village people can only be solved through military means, and she wants, you know, in order to protect her side, she wants to have the strongest weapons. So while, you know, she may be advocating violence, she's doing it for a noble reason. Meanwhile, her husband is the one who's saying, you know, no, we can't have violence. And that would have been an interesting philosophical conflict.
Well, I don't understand that, though. What noble reason does she have?
To save her people, because they are being attacked by these till people.
Oh, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Again, because she feels that her tribe is under attack, she needs, they need weapons but to she, defend but themselves. She's but not, that's she, not where it goes.
No, and also she's not of that tribe. Well, but I mean, they very
she is married to the
true,
chief.
True.
That, you know, while they are not her genetic people, they are, you know, this is where she lives.
Yeah, yeah. That would have been, yeah.
You know, being the chief's wife does give you certain responsibilities towards, you know.
I think it's a problem with this episode that the two of us who are not script writers, we are not in any way qualified to write television, I think have come up with two very different and very interesting explanations for her character and her motivations that have nothing to do with what we actually see on screen.
Yeah, again, and I'm sure there are another couple of other options that could have even worked as well that we're not even thinking of. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you make of the whole Klingon subplot?
What because... are the Klingons there for? Because the Klingons normally seem to want to go in, find the strongest guy, get the strongest guy to say, hey, the Klingons are awesome, you know, install him as the puppet king and rule that way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe that's why she wants the weapon. She just wants to have the weapon so she becomes the puppet king. I don't know. Like,
maybe, yeah.
But that isn't mentioned anywhere. That would have been another one. Like, she may not necessarily be a Klingon, but she decides, all right, they've got the strongest stuff and they're my best chance.
Well, that's an interesting take on it, I think. And I wish that also would have been in the episode, because I think that could have been a really interesting way to go.
Yeah, another set of themes, like when, you know, she's in a society where she has no real power, you know, and she believes the Klingons will give them to that
yeah,
to her.
Yeah.
And that has a lot of fascinating implications.
But that's not what happens.
No, what happens is she has this fight where she, like, they grab her, she struggles free, and she holds up the knife, and she's like, ha ha ha! And then while she's doing that, they grab her again, and she struggles free, and she holds up the knife, and she's like, ha ha! And then finally they kill her after, like, 20 hours of that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This was, like, a six-hour special episode, like, right? Like, it's not just me. This one ran long.
No, it didn't run long.
It felt like it ran long. It ran. I definitely saw too much of it.
It was 50 minutes, like all the rest of them.
It felt like.
You know, the Klingon thing is interesting, right? Because I was watching this episode and I was thinking, oh, this is, you know, two great powers, the Federation and the Klingons, using the natives to sort of fight a war by proxy, right? And they're supplying the Klingons are supplying the villagers with weapons, and they're even going so far as to make them seem homegrown, right? They're only giving them very basic sort of flintlock weapons. There's a scene there in the stealth part where McCoy and Kirk are hiding in the warehouse, and the Klingon and the villagers' leader, I suppose, is who he's supposed to be, come in, and they're actually talking, and you know, the Klingon is saying something about, oh, well, we'll show you a better way to use these weapons and to develop them so that you get some more distance, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so assumingly they're handing him weapons based on a general...
Yeah, and then the scene needs to end, and McCoy acts stupid, and, you know, his tricorder goes off for no apparent reason, and then they realize that there's someone in there.
This was a very lazy episode.
No, it is lazy. But I think, you know, you know, and I was thinking, like, oh, well, this is a commentary on Vietnam. This is a commentary on Korea. This is a commentary on the Cold War in general. You know, the Federation are Americans and the Klingons are Russians. And you've got your satellite states, you know, you've got your Soviet satellite states, you've got your American satellite states. And, you know, they're making a commentary on that. And that would be interesting. And I think that would be a cool episode.
Wait a second. What if at the end she's sacrificing herself? Because because the entire time, Kirk's goal is to convince the leader of the Hill people to want guns, and because they feel, I mean, this is one of my problems with the episode is that the episode is definitely on the side of you need to have weapons to defend yourself, like that's so the entire time Kirk is trying to convince his friend he'd been on this planet before to get weapons. He's saying no, that's not the right way. What if she, because she does fight very lazily, what if that's on purpose and she's just kind of, you know, fucking with the Hill people or the village, they're villagers.
The villagers.
She's fucking with the villagers and, you know, baiting them into killing her. Mm. And at that point, he, you know, then the husband says, oh, you know, now I want revenge, and there's, that's when he orders the guns. I mean, it's that's,
there's nothing else in this script that makes me think that it's as smart as that. And I don't see any evidence for that in the script.
Wait, see, that would have been an interesting angle. Well, yeah.
Like, well, but here's the thing, and this is why I don't think that that's true. You've got all this great stuff about, you know, satellite states and cold wars and things like that in the episode. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. And then Kirk comes right out and says it.
Yeah.
I mean, and not only says it, but he says, "Remember Vietnam?" Like, yeah. It's so lazy.
Especially when you consider that, like, how inconsistent they are with knowing, I mean, Earth history.
Kirk may as well have looked at the camera and said, "It's about Vietnam, viewers." Like, it was really dumb. Like, I just, that rubbed me the wrong way, because it was so antithetical to what Star Trek was doing. They were using science fiction to make points using allegory,
yeah,
about, you know, the 60s culture, but they had never made it that explicit. It was really out of character for the show.
And it was also fairly, number one, it's obvious to, you know, me in 2013 watching this. So it definitely would have been obvious to somebody in the middle of the Cold War. Like,
yeah, this was 1968.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they this would have been on their minds anyway. What I think is especially funny is how they, I mean, one of the sub running things of this episode is like, well, we've got to get the hill people guns, and then everyone will be even, and then we'll totally be okay. And it's like, but literally what was going on in the world at that time was an arms race in which one side got guns, then the other side got guns, then the first side got bigger guns, and that, like, you know, butter battle booked it. And
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
well, of course,
they would have known that theme at the time, like, to not even, yeah, address that, to think, like,
well, I think that's the one part of this episode that is smart, because it's not a commentary on, say, nuclear weapons, for example, because that doesn't make any sense. It's more a commentary on the great powers, and by the great powers, I mean America and the Soviet, yeah, Union in the 60s, arming other countries, arming other rebel groups. So you have the Russians giving weapons to the North Koreans. You have the Russians giving weapons to the Viet Cong.
The U.S. giving weapons to Afghanistan. Ooh.
When did they do that?
Didn't we do that?
Well, now we did.
Yeah. No, yeah.
I'm talking about in the 60s.
I'm talking throughout history.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was making controversial political.
No, but the Soviet Union did that in Afghanistan in the 80s. So
I was going to say,
this is a thing that happens. And that was, I think that was the smartest part of the episode, because at the end of it, they realize that the Klingons are going to be doing this. The Klingons are not going to stop giving the villagers weapons. And so, unfortunately, the Federation has to arm the hill people to sort of equal it out and hope that it will all hash out, yeah, and there will be some sort of, like, detente, even, ooh, if we want to get into some 60s terminology. But we know from history that that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So it really does come across as very melancholic, I think, at the very end of the episode.
And yet you would think, especially knowing that Vietnam existed, you would think that the Kirk would know where this would go. I think he's, because at one point he doesn't seem to be as aware as he's going on.
Well, that's another reason why I think that aspect of this episode is smart, because I think Kirk does realize that, but I think he knows that there's no other choice, okay, because the only other choice is that the villagers are eventually going to wipe out the hill people.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want that to happen. And he doesn't want that to happen, of course, because he lived on this planet 13 yeah. years ago, as it was established, and Tyree is his friend. But also because he wants to preserve the natural order of this planet.
No. It's one of those episodes you can see a good episode hiding in. And I think a few other episodes have touched on, if not these exact themes, had this similar structure of a plot before and did it better.
No, I agree with that. Yeah. What do you make of the Prime Directive stuff in this episode? Because I know that you find the Prime Directive interesting.
Well, just because it's a term I know.
Yeah.
I know so little. I have to say, I honestly can't really remember much Prime Directive stuff from there, and there's nothing in my notes.
Well, the only thing about the Prime Directive really in this episode, of course, is that the second time when McCoy and Kirk beam down to the planet after Spock has been shot, they go back and they're wearing the native garb and everything. The implication there is that Kirk needs to fix the natural evolution of the planet. They interfered inappropriately, or someone is interfering inappropriately, and they need to find out why, and they need to fix it. So this is actually, I think, a little bit of an addition to the Prime Directive, where the first time we hear about it, it's, you know, no identification of self and mission, you know, do not interfere with the normal evolution of the planet. Right. But it's apparently okay to try and fix it if there's a problem, which is actually what we saw last week as well in a piece of the action.
Yeah.
And I don't think they mentioned the Prime Directive in that episode specifically.
I don't remember. It's definitely alluded to, at least.
So I think it's an interesting concept, and I wonder, you know, there's really no analog to it in the real world that I can think of.
I mean, it's not dissimilar to, like, Just War type of things. I mean, it's considered a moral wrong for a country to just up and invade another country. And, you know, enough conventions, you know, where countries agree not to do that.
Sure.
Of course, you know, if there's... But it's justifiable to defend your own country, that type of thing. I mean, again, that's similar enough, since we aren't really, I assume anthropologists have some rules about contacting, you know, different civilizations and such, you know, now with studying a culture. I don't really know.
I wonder about
I think we mostly don't have it, largely because at this point, like, when this was an issue in the world in an age of exploration thing, people didn't really care about that sort of thing as much. And now that we realize we care about it, it's not as much of an issue, just because we've more or less contacted the everybody who wants to be contacted.
There's a few minor holdouts.
Exactly. And
that,
you know,
live, you know, in the middle of the Amazon. But aside from that,
the types
really
of people
any.
Who would go and see them have agreed upon some conventions of how they are going to do that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, and I would say the hostility of the environment precludes contact in the first place. So,
you know,
if we do start going into space and we do start, you know, finding other civilizations, we will need to come up with some first contact rules and some general, how are we going to, you know, but I would say that's, you know, there is going to be something along the lines of a Babylon 5 where we are figuring out these diplomacy things. So I would say there wouldn't be a Prime Directive so much as a shitload of laws.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think that's interesting, is, you know, because if you look at the original series as a Western and you look at it from the point of view of, you know, the implication there, of course, is that the galaxy is largely unexplored in the original series, and the Federation and the Enterprise specifically are out there making contact with many alien civilizations and life forms and discovering a lot of things that no one has ever seen before. And so you don't know what's going to be dangerous, and you don't know what has the capability to destroy you. And so to stay away from it may be a good policy.
That it does make sense. You know, we'll let the professionals handle these things, but, you know, and obviously Kirk and his, you know, crew are very well trained. You know, they know first contact protocol backwards and forwards. And this is something that people over, you know, have refined over years, we assume.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, maybe that's it. But the average person, you stay the understood roots right now.
Yeah. Okay. I think the last thing we have to talk about is the Mugato.
Okay.
It's a classic Star Trek thing. It doesn't really have any sort of purpose in the episode whatsoever.
I don't know what you're
talking
about.
It's just there to attack Kirk.
What is this?
The giant white gorilla.
Oh, that thing! Yeah, the Yeti!
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was like, it was this great sophisticated episode about, you know, it was this great sophisticated episode arms race and, you know, cultural relativism and, you know, the morality of violence. And, you know, suddenly a fucking Yeti comes and they have, like, the Godzilla sound effect in the background. It was great. I
think it's kind of charming.
It is, because you can see the zipper and it's wonderful. You
know? I just, you know, it's so cool because the original series is just so good at being goofy. But it's goofy in a really endearing way. It's not goofy in a, you know, there are other television shows that are as goofy as the original series that have not aged well and are basically unwatchable anymore. And this sort of thing, I think, really goes to show you that a willingness to just go with it and, like, believe in what you're doing and just committing to it is the way to go.
Well, I have to say, like, at that point in the episode, what attacked Kirk was the exact last thing that I had been expecting. It completely took me by surprise. I laughed and was a little shocked at it because, like, whoa! You know, like, because, you know, you watch.
What is this?
Yeah, like, I'm watching it. I'm like, all right, you know, Kirk, desert, it's happening. Okay, they're in Southern California again for the day.
Oh,
what? A Yeti? Oh, my God!
And we didn't even mention that. This is only the second episode in the second season that we've seen any location shooting in.
That's good.
So, obviously, this had a budget for whatever reason. didn't spend it on the Mugatu. But, yeah. And, of course, you know, and the funny thing is that Animal makes absolutely no sense because they're basically in the desert and it's white like a polar bear, which, how does this thing evolve?
See, what I figured was they probably, you know, were going through, like, the bins in the studio and they found you know, maybe, like, in 1949 they filmed, like, Attack of the Yeti or something like that, and it was this horror movie Yeti that, like, and they just,
was,
like...
It was actually made for this episode.
Well, that's stupid! Like, hey. I figured it was reusing a costume and that made sense. Like, okay, you know, you're saving some pennies, it doesn't... But again, exact last thing you'd expect, a snow white thing in a red desert.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess it doesn't need to make any sense, really.
Well, look, that thing can eat anything. So it's not like, you know, it needs to camouflage itself.
And it is kind of creepy because, of course, it works on the sort of cobra thing where it poisons you before it eats you, which is kind of neat.
Yeah.
I guess the last thing we can talk about before we move on to Return to Tomorrow. We've been talking a lot about how this episode is a mess and how it has too much plot and it's overstuffed. It was also written by Roddenberry. And I think this is the only episode that we've seen aside from The Cage that has been written by him.
Well, number one, that was probably why they...
So what does that mean?
That's probably why they gave it a budget then, because it's like, oh, I wrote the script. We're gonna make it a Mugatu or whatever.
Yeah, we have a budget for three location shooting episodes in this season, and one of them is going to be the episode written by Roddenberry.
Yeah, coincidental.
And the teleplay was by Roddenberry. The story was not. So, that kind of implication
weird
to me is that the script as written was really bad, and Roddenberry made it better, which is kind of scary to think about.
You know, it's one of those, maybe he's just really good at coming up with characters and coming up with a world and coming up with a concept and a philosophy and a premise. Obviously he is, because, you know, we would not...
He created the show.
Yes, he created this franchise. Like, everything came, you know, based on his ideas. He had a very rich, you know, but, you know, maybe just like George Lucas, who can come up with a really great story and something that will touch a lot of people, but is just not really good at implementing it himself. There are a lot
that
of
could be, yeah.
There are a lot of writers like that. That's my main issue with Neil Gaiman. Like, I think he has really interesting ideas about worlds and stuff, and his characters are really interesting. I like his phrasings, but he just doesn't really know how to finish his stories, or he doesn't usually pick the best story to fit into that particular world. When he's, you know, The Sandman or the book he wrote with Terry Pratchett are much more fleshed out. So yeah, that may just be it. Maybe just Roddenberry does not know how to write. Not everyone's a good script writer.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, you know, and I think that's interesting in light of the fact that most of the Star Trek that Roddenberry had a direct hand in is charitably regarded as not the best, let's say.
Okay.
The first season of The Next Generation, the first Star Trek movie.
Ooh.
So, yeah.
I saw part of the first Star Trek movie once.
Oh, well, we will talk about it in about...
I am not looking forward to
it. We'll talk about it in, what, about 3 or 4 months, I guess?
Oh, God, that soon.
All right, let's triple it out.
4 tribbles.
I'm going to give it 6.
Did this have Chekhov in it?
It did not.
Five tribbles!
Well, maybe it did. I think he was in the very beginning of the episode.
4.5 tribbles.
Okay. All right, let's move on to Return to Tomorrow. So I have very mixed feelings about this episode.
Okay.
There are some things about it that I won't say like, but I admire and can kind of see what they were trying to do.
Okay.
But there are other things that just don't work, and I'm not interested in the main problem of the episode whatsoever.
Okay.
And so for me, this episode is very problematic, I'll say.
Well, there's a set of reasons I find it very problematic.
Okay, well, what are your reasons?
Energy beings.
Yes, okay.
Motherfucking energy beings.
We need to get that out of the way.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, this is going to get zero tribbles from me just because I don't care. The Vorlons are the only types of energy beings I'm okay with.
But it should get an additional one because there's no Chekhov in this episode.
Yeah, no. It's like there's a hierarchy
and
of these things.
And Sulu is back, so maybe it should get another one.
No, I hate energy beings more than I hate Chekhov.
Wow.
And more than I like Sulu. So now this is like a negative 1 million tribbles.
You're going to need to come up with some sort of like algebraic equation for this, I think.
I think I'm just going to arbitrarily make up things as I go along and just give numbers based on my weird mood at the moment. So zero tribbles.
So okay, energy beings, that's number one. What else?
Energy beings. We apparently come from aliens, the alien seed theory. That's one. That's another.
Well, okay, that's actually really interesting.
Is it?
In light of much later stuff that happens in Star Trek. But I will leave it at that. We will talk about it in about 2 years. So just remember that. Make a note of it. And
how
remember,
will I possibly remember something 2 years
I'm telling
now?
You to make a note, so make a note. What else is problematic?
I love Kirk's speech, and I know you hate it, but I love Kirk's speech.
Yeah, well, okay. I
is that one of your problematic bits?
It is one of my problematic bits of the episode. So the episode is set up. There's not a lot of plot in this episode, which is very different from A Private Little War, where there was too much plot. The Enterprise is called to a planet by this disembodied voice named Sargon. Turns out that he's a floating energy being in a jar. They need their bodies because they're stuck and they're the remnants of a civilization that died or something. We don't really know. They want to borrow 3 bodies to build androids for themselves so that they can go out and explore the galaxy. And Dr. McCoy thinks this is a very bad idea. Because Sargon does take over Kirk's body without asking, and there's something with the biochemistry of having an energy being in your head that causes the human body to react badly with increased heartbeat and all these kind of metabolic reactions, and it will eventually kill you, which is all fine.
Yeah, it's overclocking people. All right.
And there's a scene about midway through the episode where Kirk and McCoy and Scotty and maybe Spock, I don't remember, are all sitting around a table, and Kirk gives this very impassioned speech about how they're out there to take risks and space is not safe. And, we're on a Star Trek, guys, and we need to help people and all. And just
I loved it. I stood up and clapped and signed up for Starfleet immediately.
And if they wanted to use that as a Starfleet recruiting tool, that would have been fine.
I'm sorry. Like, I love
it's just like the main theme music swells up, and I just. It was too much like, hey, I'm watching a television show to me.
That's the thing. Like, Shatner's a ham, but I love watching Shatner ham it up. Because no matter what, when Shatner overacts, he's really entertaining. And he was overacting that scene, and it was just, he was 100% in it. Like,
well,
Kirk comes off as just extremely crazy passionate, and that works.
In general, we haven't talked about this, but in general, I watching these episodes in order, Shatner, of course, has a reputation for overreacting and eating the scenery a little bit, which in the first season, I don't really see that that's a justified complaint. In the second season, he's definitely doing it a lot more.
And yeah, you can see it as the series has progressed. The way he, the Shatner pause that everyone makes fun. Right. He didn't do that in the first season, but he's doing it now.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know,
and you can see, which is him developing his own quote unquote technique. But again, I feel like it works. I feel
and that's, I will never criticize the Shatner technique because I love it. I mean, he is Kirk as far as I'm concerned. Chris Pine can play Kirk for as long as he wants to, but he's never going to be Kirk the way Shatner is Kirk.
Yeah, again, and Kirk burns at a very high intensity all the time. So yeah, you need an actor who is at that level all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
He has a very high energy, and I love that.
And I want to say I don't have a problem with that scene because of Shatner at all. He totally sells it. I just have a problem with the writing.
And that's fair. You know,
and a problem with the directing, too, because, you know, Kirk is giving this impassioned speech, and it's very sort of rote, and it's very sort of like, oh, we're going to give a mission statement for the show, which we've already done many times before in a much better fashion. Don't try and compete with City on the Edge Forever, guys. You know, reaction shot from McCoy being appropriately awed and a reaction shot from Scotty, who is looking at Kirk like he wants to sleep with him. There's a reaction shot from Mulville or whatever the fuck her name is. Looking appropriately turned on. And it's just like, I don't know. It didn't work for me.
If it had been like a tenth of a degree toned down, I think it would not have worked as much, but I think it was at the exact level of cheesiness that scene needed to be.
Okay, that's fair. And then, of course, you know, they decide that they're going to do it, and they're going to let these aliens take their bodies over and work on creating these androids. And this comes in with my second problem with the episode, is that most of the episode centers around a love triangle between Sargon, one of the other energy beings that has survived is his wife. Another one is apparently in love with Sargon's wife. And so you have this weird love triangle effect. It also turns out that the energy being that's in love with Sargon's wife is apparently a serial killer. This is all fine. And Leonard Nimoy does a great job playing a creepy ass motherfucker.
Another thing that I loved about this episode, as possessed, you could tell Nimoy is enjoying the hell out of, you know, playing a very different character.
Yeah, like I have no problems with the performances in this episode whatsoever. I just have a problem with centering an episode around three characters that we don't really care about and we never see again. I think it would have been more interesting if the female person who had been inhabited by the alien would have been Uhura or even Nurse Chapel.
Oh, no, it would have been Yeoman Rand.
Because
that, you know, this entire time he and Yeoman Rand would have had an on again, off and off again thing. And maybe even at this point, something would have happened between Spock and Yeoman Rand that would have caused Kirk to get like, you know, to misinterpret and get jealous for the wrong reasons, but there's still a resonance of that. That could have been an element here. This is, again, you have to give a tiny bit of serialization in order to do that. But I think
Nurse Chapel would have worked as well, and I think Nurse Chapel would have maybe worked better because, of course, we know that Nurse Chapel has a secret infatuation with Spock, and it would have been interesting to see that go the other way, where Spock has this sort of overt infatuation with her and she's not into it, and of course it wouldn't actually have been them, but it would have been interesting to see the tables turn like that.
I do think it was more interesting how they did it here with her being, you know, just normal, you know, Norman Nurse Chapel, who, you know, is in love with Spock, and then suddenly someone in Spock's body is hitting on her, and that's a very complex set of emotions that she must be having at this point about that.
Yeah.
So, you know, having her be possessed by someone else would have taken that out of the equation. And poor Yeoman Rand, because, you know, poor one out for my homies, but poor Nurse Chapel this week, because, you know, this week she has to deal with her love is possessed by an evil spirit who's hypnotizing her and trying to kill everybody. And the week before, you know, she had to see Spock almost die and had to hit him to wake him up. And then
we didn't talk about that.
And then Scotty's like, woman, what are you doing? And she's all, but I'm trying to save him. And then the doctor's like, ah. And
Yeah, she's not having a good couple of weeks on the Enterprise, basically.
You know, she's gonna. Yeah, she's. I don't think we'll see her in the next episode. She will be at the booby hatch.
I don't remember if we do or not, but yeah, and I the thing is too about this episode. Like I said, I mean, it's appropriately creepy, but Sargon is not interesting as a character. He's very, very vanilla, very like wallpaper. Mulhall is not really a character either, and her
energy girl of the week.
Yeah, her energy being is not very interesting. And so you kind of get this, I don't know, it's like it suddenly becomes dangerous for no particular reason other than they needed to wrap the episode up.
Well, again, talk about stakes. So we lose these three energy beings. I don't see why that's a bad thing. So they, you know, whether they,
right,
whether they make, obviously, yes, when, you know, evil Spock starts attacking, yes, that's a stake. But up till this point, what do we lose? They don't make that clear.
Well, they try and make it clear a little bit in the beginning where Kirk is talking about, you know, we don't know how much these aliens could teach us.
And, oh, well, they've done that so many times before, and, like, humanity has learned nothing from energy beings at this
point. It's like, Kirk, come on, it never works out, dude.
Look, just talk to Baylock. Where is Baylock this entire time, by the way? Like, I wanted to, like, you know how in the last season of, like, Three's Company, they'd have Suzanne Summers come, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I want to just have Baylock, you know, calling everyone, hello, Kirk, you know, just telling him what he's up to that day, you know? Him and his red shirt boyfriend that, you know, yeah, now yeah. Baylock has, like, you know, just the two of them, you know, just sitting back and drinking Tranya, you know, I want that.
I would like to see that spinoff, actually.
Yeah, you know.
You know, maybe if the Harry Mudd spinoff had actually happened, there would have been an episode where he encounters Baylock.
Baylock and me. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Oh, man. Baylock and Harry Mudd have to team up. And, like, every episode, like, Baylock uses that, the doll to, like, perform a prank on somebody, like... That's one of the, like, every episode type things. You know, I'm having so much more fun talking about this hypothetical Baylock spinoff than I am talking about either of these episodes today.
Well, okay, but the other thing about Return to Tomorrow as well is sort of the end of the episode where, you know, there's all this sort of, like, musical chair sort of like farcical comedy going on, but it's not funny, but it's sort of in that vein where, you know, Kirk dies and they think that Sargon is dead, but Kirk is back in his body and he's okay. And then, you know, Mulhall is, I'm back to being Mulhall. And then, you know, the receptacles have burned up and, you know, McCoy's flipping out because he's like, you just killed Spock. He was a loyal officer. Like, you know, and it turns out that Spock was in Nurse Chapel's body, and Spock
Which, poor Nurse Chapel.
Yeah, you know, poor Nurse Chapel. She's having a bad week, and then suddenly there's a cut to Uhura yelling on the bridge because evil Spock is doing something to her. We don't know what. Yeah. Because suddenly these aliens have, like, magical killing powers.
Eric, I'm going to be very honest. This was, again, one of those segments where shit's happening and I don't understand what it was, but I just am watching it all and just saying, okay, well, the plot's being resolved, so, you know, just in 5 minutes it'll all be over. Like, well, that's how I was taking that segment.
They were trying to trick the evil entity that was in Spock to leave, basically.
Yeah, and I got that, but I guess it didn't really matter how they were fixing it, since I didn't care about the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, if the episodes where the problem is a genuine mystery or it is genuinely interesting, like the Nomad episode, I genuinely believed that Nomad was a danger, and how are they going to take this one down? What is Kirk going to do? What is his plan going to be? Here, I was not really worried about what the plan was going to be, because I just figured, all right, well, he'll fix it, and... You know, Kirk's got this one. I'll let him take care of it.
Well, again,
they have God on their side on this episode. I think the heroes will be all right.
Well, we'll get to that. But
we have to
again? Let's talk about stakes.
Yeah,
there aren't any in this episode, really. I mean, the whole episode is centering on the success of three energy being aliens that we've never seen before and don't really care about, successfully building android bodies for themselves so they can go to Paris, basically, is what I get from the episode. And that may have been interesting, but I don't find that all that interesting. And it has nothing really to do with the Enterprise or their mission. And it doesn't really ever come across very interestingly. And again, the love triangle is not interesting. And so there just aren't any stakes in this episode whatsoever until the very end when they try and ratchet up the tension by having evil Spock go crazy. But it's all resolved in a very sort of like slapdash, this is magic fashion.
What is it with episodes that have the word tomorrow in them and a slapdash ending? I mean, come on. It's... And I have to say, that's the speech like, well, there's weird shit out there and we've got to do it because we're on a Star Trek. I mean, then they do it and it turns out to blow up in their faces and they just, you know, manage to escape from being, you know, all killed. So doesn't that kind of like contradict the entire theme of the series that like it's good to explore?
That's actually a good point.
Like, and McCoy, who has said the entire time, like, look, something smells off about this. Like, I'd rather not do this. Well, he was right the entire time. They shouldn't have done this.
That's actually true. And I mean, if you want to take that to its logical conclusion, what are they getting out of being in space? And what are they getting out of exploring it? They don't seem to be getting anything other than a lot of grief.
Well, one could think about that way about life. I mean, this could kind of imply that, you know,
you got to do something with your life. Well,
not,
I guess.
Not really. Camus said that the first response of the intellectual to the meaninglessness of the universe is suicide.
Yeah. I mean,
and which is where we saw Captain Pike at the beginning of The Cage.
That's a good point, where he was feeling very
just like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, in Wrath of Khan, that's essentially where Kirk is as well, because he's saying like, I'm older, I'm bored, like, why did I do any of that? What am I going to do with my life? This is pointless.
And I mean, of course, we do know that it's not pointless, because
enough
the exploration that the Enterprise is engaged in, if not in this episode, at least in general, they meet friends, they make the Earth safer. You know, they do things like that, which are important and which actually do have tangible benefits.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think any of us, I think we generally don't agree with that it's meaningless.
Absolutely, yeah.
The show would not be a thing if people did not think that it had meaning.
This is not Battlestar Galactica, in effect, I guess.
And so, I guess that's another reason this is a bad episode, because it doesn't seem to... Halfway through, they forget the entire philosophy and moral stance of the entire series. Like, maybe that's it. Like, this is a bad episode because it just contradicts itself. This is not what Star Trek is supposed to be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I kind of agree with that, and I find the whole tone of the episode, it feels off. Like, the episode just feels off to me. And I think part of the reason why it feels off as well is the direction, right? Because I don't think he directed the original series before.
Okay, it's not like a Joseph Bev movie.
No, I don't think so. And there's a lot of like off camera angles, and he uses a lot of like low camera angles and things like that, which give the episode a feeling of being off, which of course makes sense because two of our characters and special guest lady this week are not themselves. But it also makes the show feel weird to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Because Star Trek is an anthology, it's allowed to go outside of its own formula from time to time, and stuff like, you know, Mudd's Women. That was a wacky comedy episode. That was a very broad, almost slapstick. And, you know, because it's an anthology, it can do that. Something like Devil in the Dark, which was much more creepy and cerebral, you know, that fits in it as well. Something, you know, so it can do a lot of different types of stories, but they strayed too far on this one. So I think, and that's similar to how I find the Block episodes, I find he's straying too far from it.
Yeah, that could be. That could be.
Yeah. It misses the point of what Star Trek is, I think.
Well, let's talk about the ending a little bit, because I you know, we talk about Star Trek. I mean, in the last episode, Private Little War, we talked about it would have been helped by not making the allegory so explicit. But I think in this episode, it would have helped to make it a little more explicit.
Well, let me ask you this. What the hell is this an allegory for?
Well, that's the thing. I don't think it's an allegory so much, but I think there is an undercurrent there Sargon is almost supposed to be God. And at the very end of the episode, it is obvious at the very end of the episode, I think, that Sargon is at least not supposed to be God, but is supposed to stand in for God.
God-ish.
Because he's calling them my children, yeah. And he's saying, we have too much power. We cannot handle these bodies. We need to leave. There's the implication that they created life on Earth. And so we don't really, I mean, if you look at this episode, maybe perhaps as not energy beings, but fallen gods.
Yeah, but we had an episode about fallen gods that was much better.
What episode was that?
The Apollo episode, where we have an alien who is part of a race of aliens who are so advanced that humanity considers them gods. Again, and this is a concept that's I've not just seen in Star Trek, but in general,
sure.
That, you know, an alien that is 3 billion times us and, you know, God as we understand it, the difference is kind of irrelevant because they're going, you know, any sufficiently advanced technology is mad. Yeah.
I was about to say that, yeah.
And you have at the end realizing that being a god to a race that no longer needs it and is now self-sufficient is a sad existence. And at the end you have Apollo realizing that, you know, everyone else of his race realized that it was time for them to move on. And it's him accepting that, you know, no, you're right. I'm done. I've got to go.
And we don't really see that in this episode.
I mean, it's kind of at the end, you know, Sargon is all, we need android bodies. And then you realize, oh, we're a little too powerful. Like, maybe we shouldn't have android bodies. I mean, that is an implication that they did advance so much that they just need to advance away. And that's the next step.
I guess, well, you know, it's funny because I don't think that he realizes that the android bodies are the problem. I think he realizes that giving them the ability to interact with, I'm going to say lower life forms, even though maybe that's not particularly appropriate, but it's a terminology that we can use. Yeah. Is really the danger there. Right. And so it's not that they're too powerful for the android bodies, but having them allows them to engage in relationships that would tempt them into doing things that they should not be doing.
Okay. Fair enough. And, you know, could just, I mean, it's very literal that, you know, being possessed by one of these things overclocks the human body to death, you know. And
well, yeah, well, I mean, we
so didn't... that's a very literal thing of these are too powerful for us to deal with, and just they need to realize they need to move on because they're too advanced beyond us.
And I mean, we didn't even really talk about that whole subplot. I mean, that's where we see the Spock alien the first time we see him being a problem, where one of the reasons why they agree to let the aliens take over three of their bodies is because they can synthesize this formula that allows their metabolism to catch up to the aliens. And you know, Spock gives Kirk a lesser dose, and eventually that's going to kill him so that he can take Sargon's wife for himself, I guess.
Yeah, and because what, you know, Sargon's wife does seem to enjoy being embodied as much as evil Spock. And do we remember his name?
No.
As much as evil Spock does. And
really, though, this is the temptation of the flesh, right? I mean, this is even kind of like a kind of an anti-sex episode in a way, a weird way.
Oh, no. Think about this. This is another Garden of Eden episode, because the entire time everyone's all, well, Spock looks like Satan. And he is tempting a woman against her husband to the flesh, which is essentially, I mean, we don't have an apple here, but we have a red colored vial.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
I mean, there's some resonances of that. They're trying to create a paradise, but, you know, it turns out that they are the flesh itself breeds corruption, it almost suggests. they can't, you know, the flesh is so pleasurable that, because the entire time they're even saying, like, just something simple as breathing is wonderful. Like, every single one of them says, oh, it's great to breathe.
And again, that makes sense,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. You know, wow, I can see, you know, and obviously, you know, Sargon and his wife are very interested in boning. You know, they say, like, oh, wow, you're in a very, that's a very comely body you possess there. So, you know, there are so many things that they can do, and having an android body is such a gross parody of life. It's going, they will be able to move around and all of that, but they won't be able to have an orgasm, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes one wonder, though, like, if they're so advanced, why can't they? But anyway.
Or why can't they just grow bodies?
Yeah.
You know, like, that would seem to be a more easy solution.
Yeah. Or they just say, like, all right, well, we'll be in these android bodies for a while. And then now that we're in, once we're in bodies, we'll be able to do some more physical experiments. Because let's just say, assume that they needed to do some physical experiments to do that. Well, android bodies are going to be indefinite, and they got all the time in the world.
Yeah.
At one
yeah.
point, they even say, like, we've been waiting thousands of years. If we need to wait a little more, you know, we'll deal with it.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, before we wrap this up, I do want to mention one other thing about this episode, which you may find interesting. I don't know if you will, but
I'm going to not find it interesting, just to spite
you. The woman who plays Malhill in this episode comes back, I believe, in the third season as a different character. And she also comes back as a regular cast member in the second season of The Next Generation.
Oh, boy. That's
so,
a very interesting story.
Diana Mulder has a long and sort of brief history in the Star Trek franchise, but it's interesting to see how they used her in it and
so
how she kept coming back.
She's just like a recurring in TNG?
No, she's a main cast member in TNG for in the second season.
What's the character's name?
Dr. Pulaski.
Okay, I don't know that character.
You probably haven't seen much of the second season of The Next Generation.
Yeah.
I know that you've seen a few episodes
of
it here
and
there.
Yeah, I've seen later episodes, yeah. But okay.
So I just wanted to
bring
that up.
She's obviously not one of the major characters, I would assume.
She is. No, she is. She's a main cast member.
But I mean, like, to the effect of, like, when you think of TNG, you're thinking of, like, you know, Picard.
Well,
she was only
there for one season.
Yeah,
And most people don't consider the second season to be the best, necessarily.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So that's probably it.
Yeah, but I just wanted to mention that just to watch out for her, because she does come back.
Watch out.
All right, so how many tribbles would you give this one?
I would give this zero tribbles because it had energy beings. I told you.
I'll give it four.
That would probably be a four tribble episode if it didn't have energy beings.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
Fuck energy beings, man. Like, I'm made of light, boy!
You can't. Were you not paying attention
to
the episode?
Yeah, exactly, which is why it's like, what's the point of an energy being? Like, I can't make out with it.
Yeah. Well, next week, we will be talking about Patterns of Force and By Any Other Name.
Now, let me ask you something.
Yes.
Can I make out with anything in either episode?
Yes.
Great. I will give them 100 tribbles.
Okay. We'll see you then.